Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Renewable energy is becoming more common than it was several decades ago, but it still hasn't crossed the chasm into most people's daily lives. Tonight on the show, Bob Solger, founder of the local Solar Design Studio, a company that helps integrate solar power generation into residential and commercial buildings, will discuss how changing the structure of energy companies' business models may allow renewable energy to become integrated into the common energy supply chain. This show was recorded on December 2nd at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show begins with the speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Good morning. My name is Craig Vollen. I'm a member of the forum committee. The forum exists to afford a platform for the discussion of significant issues, especially those which involve ethical values in the contemporary world. This morning, we're really fortunate. This is a very topical issue, especially with the new report on climate change. We have Bob Solger of the Solar Design Studio here in Kansas City. Bob is a longtime energy expert in our region. In fact, he's kind of a pioneer. He started around here in 2003, which is about when solar panels became economical enough. He's a longtime energy expert and began his energy journey as founder and owner of the Energy Saving Store. Upon the sale of his store, Bob founded the Solar Design Studio, an international firm that specializes in photovoltaic design, consulting, financing, and engineering. So we're very fortunate to have a real expert here. Bob?
Thanks, Craig. Well, good morning to everybody. Hopefully everybody can hear me. So I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you a little bit this morning about the electric grid in transition, or really known, or how I would refer to it as a utility business model reform. Because what we'll explore this morning is really utilities business and what's impacting the changes that utilities are experiencing today and what their possible plans are going into the future based on the issue. So we hope to provide to you an understanding of how utilities are structured and how they're regulated, the need for utility reform, the structures, the reform structures, and how they'll be implemented. And I want to share with you, too, a perspective what's going on in Missouri and Kansas, and really nationwide, and we'll have a wrap-up. I know we're going to have questions and answers period, so I certainly welcome that. So without further ado, we'll actually get started in terms of the structures of utilities. As we know, utilities, they're really their context or their structure. There's three main structures. There's the investor-owned utility structure, which KCPL, Westar, are investor-owned utilities here in the area. They really represent the predominant supplier of power to customers in the customer base. Over 65% of power that's purchased comes from investor-owned utilities. And they are regulated entities, as we all know. They do have a monopoly in the regions they serve. So there are also municipal utilities in the area, and of course, KCK Board of Public Utilities, City of Independence are considered municipal utilities. They are governed by the local Board of Aldermen, for example, or city councils. And in the case of municipal utilities, some have generation resources, others don't. They buy from other generation resources depending upon their location. In Missouri, last count I understood there were 109 municipal utilities in Missouri. I don't have a count in Kansas, but there is quite a bit of activity with municipal utilities and renewables in Kansas as well as Missouri. In the renewables area here, Independence, they built their own solar farm, and I understand they're going to expand them. There are several municipal utilities around the state of Missouri that have built large solar farms in the 1 to 10 megawatt range. In fact, there's a good company here in Kansas City that specializes in that business, and that being MC Power. They've really built a nice business around building those large projects. On the other hand, there's electrical co-ops that serve the rural areas. As we know, we might have heard the term, or those of us that have lived in rural areas or were raised in rural areas, rural electric co-ops. Well, there's many of them in the state. Some that you may be familiar with here in the area, Platte Clay Electric, for example, is a very progressively run electric co-op. They actually have their own community solar program that they launched a couple of years ago. It was first of its kind for this area. But they, in the case of electrical co-ops, are owned by their members, and they are governed by a board. They buy their power through a generation group or called Associated, which supplies power to all the co-ops in the state of Missouri and some into Iowa, as I understand it. So we have three main structures of utilities that we're going to talk a little bit about in the how their electric grid or their business model is being reformed. So the utility markets, as we may be familiar with, really can be categorized in three ways. There's the type of market that's highly monopolized, like, for example, here in Missouri, companies like KCPL, Ameren, Empire, which is now called Liberty, I believe, are investor-owned utilities that have invested in generation, distribution, and retail resources. So the market, there's no competitive companies providing power in the Missouri market and in Kansas. In turn, you have deregulated markets that California started out as a deregulated market, but it was suspended due to problems. If it goes back in history, we've heard of a company called Enron, for example. But in a deregulated market, you have companies that are coming in and being able to sell services such as electricity to customers. They're buying their power from a generation company, and in some cases maybe competing with a division of that company at the retail level. So you're finding companies in deregulated markets offering services and power to customers at different price points, different plans, and so forth. So active markets close to where we're at here, the Illinois market recently passed legislation that enabled more competition in the market, and it has enabled the market to evolve for renewables as well. So there's some positive things that happen with deregulation if it's managed properly. As you can see by the map, the yellow states suspended their program, where the green states have active programs, and the white states are not deregulated markets. So it's interesting how these markets are organized from a standpoint when you look at, again, the term is they're vertically integrated. They have generation, distribution, and billing resources all in one company, and that's what we have. Whereas when it's not, or it's deregulated, it's the monopoly is parts of it are broken up and replaced by competing sellers of services. So that's one of the trends that's impacting the market. And then in turn, the utility markets and balancing authorities, how they're organized, you've heard the term of power pools, for example. You have the regional transmission operators and the independent systems operators. These are groups that are organized in geographical parts of the country to manage the transmission of power for purposes of balancing and reducing operational cost. Not all parts of the country are organized into regional transmission operators, but this is you've heard the organization like this area is part of Southwest Power Pool, for example. Then you the other part of portions to the east, like in Illinois, is part of MISO, the Midwest Independent Systems Operators. Those are two that we've done some business in those areas, and we have some familiarities with them. So, but these authorities are actually regulated by the Federal Energy Regulation Corporation or Commission, FERC. And they're the federal governing body that regulates these entities. And that's important to understand because occasionally you hear on the news about changes or rules making or direction given by FERC back to the utilities or some pushback. And of late, what's of interest to our business, those of us in the solar industry, is FERC directed the utilities and the RTOs to begin to look more closely at storage, particularly battery storage technologies, and how they might be used to address issues affecting the grid. So that was a big plus for the industry in terms of going forward. So when you think about the interactions of a utility in terms of how they have to respond to the market, they are governed by the state legislature in cases that will pass laws, and we'll talk a little bit later about what has transpired in Missouri in terms of some grid modernization activities. You have state public utility commissions or the Public Service Commission, or in Kansas you have the Kansas Corporation Commission that regulates utilities. So, and then you have the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, again, regulating utilities. So, and what's transpiring at these levels are policies that impact how a utility is going to conduct business, and that it may involve the establishment of a renewable portfolio standard, energy efficiency initiatives, for example, carbon pricing, peak demand shaving programs, and then transportation electrification and building electrification. These are newer initiatives that are being launched from a policy perspective to promote alternatives and give opportunities actually to the utilities to sell their product. Case in point, KCPL a few years ago announced that they were investing in deploying 1,500 electric vehicle charging stations. That's an outlet for them to sell more product and promote electrical vehicles. And that's has to be, or there are requirements generally levied where they have to have permission to do these things from the Public Service Commission, ultimately establishing tariffs, for example, or rate structures related to electric vehicles. And that's a exciting growth area for a lot of reasons, because it's an alternative to the oil industry in powering vehicles. And electric vehicles are one of the exciting trends that are going to benefit the electrical companies going forward. So, again, that's governed by policies, for example, as well as marketing demand. So just with this background, this gives us an idea then of what is the need for reform in terms of how utilities are doing conducting business and what pressures are on them from a standpoint of conducting business. Keep in mind, a utility is in business to generate revenues and make profits. That's what anybody's business is about. And in the case of a regulated utility, it is a monopoly. And again, they are influenced by Public Service Commission, state legislature, federal policy, and of course, the local market. So these factors figure into the market structure, how they plan their business, planning and investments into their business, how they design rates, i.e., or tariffs, when you look at your electric bill, depending upon where you live, what rate structure you have. Generally, it's residential for homeowners, but if you have a business, there are different rate structures depending upon the size of building and so forth, or your business. So how those rates are designed, and if you're a solar customer, for example, what's involved with how you're compensated from a net metering perspective. And there's some changes that have been implemented in Kansas for solar customers, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. So the rate design is important as well. In turn, there's also the day-to-day operations of running the business itself in terms of generating revenues and ultimately profit. That's, in effect, the business model that we're talking about. So, but keep in mind, back to the planning and the grid modernization, when we talk about grid modernization, that term as a general term actually means some specific things, because when we talk about grid modernization, we're talking about distributed energy generation, we're talking about tools for planning to acquire and dispatch power to where it's needed, efficiency, that is the efficiency deployment of assets, as well as digital operations. Technology's here, and there's a lot of cool things in technology that have been implemented and will be implemented in the utility industry. One case in point, there's a technology called blockchain technology, which gets a lot of press, depending upon where you read, but the bottom line is with blockchain technology, it reduces the cost of transactions associated with buying and selling something, and it also offers security features in a transaction. In the case in point, how that is important, if you're a solar customer, for example, with battery storage, if you generate power and then you're going to sell it, how is that transaction handled? This blockchain technology offers an efficient way with which to do that. And there are some utilities around the country, or actually around the world, that are conducting pilot projects with this type of software technology to handle the transactions and so forth. So that in itself is quite exciting. But grid modernization is also driving a lot of new opportunities for job creation as well. So that's quite important from the perspective of changes in the economy and putting people to work. So so the need for reform then is how do you deliver on your existing expectations as a utility? Whenever we walk into a room, we all have an expectation that when we flip the switch, the light's going to go on, right? Okay, so that's current state of affairs. But what's the future? And again, we talked a little bit about grid modernization. You think about also electric vehicles, more renewables, distributed energy generation. A lot of factors will affect how utilities conduct business in the future, and that's going to put pressure on their revenue generation and their profitability. So they have to perform in an effective manner. So look at their current business model, which is reflected here, where you, the longstanding responsibilities of providing power in a safe and reliable manner at an affordable cost, that, which is key. And we have low rates in this area, as everybody knows, for a variety of factors, and that is quite important. But again, looking at the future in terms of what's impacting the utility business model, environmental performance, for example, climate change, which has been in the news this week. We also have resilience issues, grid resilience issues, and that can be impacted by emergencies, whether it's fires in California, hurricanes or tornadoes adversely impacting an area. Cybersecurity is key. So that's important in the areas of resiliency. And then choice, expanded choice for customers for deregulated markets. Those are all factors that affect a utility's business model. And then, again, we talked about new technology, innovation, specifically the business I'm in dealing with solar and storage, the impact on a grid, the value of solar and storage, for example, not only to whether you're a homeowner or a business owner attempting to reduce your own cost, but what's the impact on the area that you deploy a system in to as more systems proliferate in an area. And so those are important factors that are going to impact the business model and transition from the current state of affairs to a future state of affairs. And so that puts pressure on how the business is actually going to perform. So and think a few points in terms of the pressure on that business model. And folks that are work for utilities, that are investor-owned utilities, they have an obligation to their shareholders to run a profitable business. And the folks that I've worked with different utilities, they're very diligent about that, and they care about that because that's really their responsibility. So in turn, when you look at the utilities expanding responsibilities and expectation on the points that we talked about with safety, reliability, and affordability and environmental performance, resiliency, and expanded choice and innovation, what limits are imposed upon them to actually perform and hit their performance objectives? A point is often made about how a person performs and behaves in a business. Well, if you know how they're measured and incentives, that's how you understand their performance. And in the case of financial compensation programs, clearly defined financial objectives, if you understand them, you know how that person's going to perform. And that's quite important if you want to enable change, because if performance incentives are tied to, for example, environmental performance, you see utility decisions being made that reflect the direction associated with environmental performance or the introduction of new technologies, innovation, and so forth. But there are limitations on this business model in terms of how monies are budgeted and allocated for operating the business, whether it's expanding the business with capital expenditures or operating the business, or in evaluating current generation resources like this coal plant, for example, is it financially, economically feasible to run this plant or shut it down? And what are the alternatives of either keeping an asset generating or shutting it down? And utilities offer incentives for customers to reduce their usage so they can look at shutting down perhaps a resource, a generation resource that's really not economically feasible to continue running. It's expensive to run, continue running that plant. So those are important points. And then the designing of rates as rate structures change in terms of how that impacts the customer or the utility's business model, and any risk that's involved as well, because utilities in general are conservatively run businesses, and you want to mitigate or reduce as much risk as possible. So the expectations, the limitations on the utility's business model is affected by many factors, so which is a key point. So when we look at reform, what are the options for reforming the utility business in going forward and what the future is going to look like? Well, to begin with, how are adjustments made to cost services in terms of how is the revenue going to be derived? Do you decouple the revenue from different aspects of the business for a utility, for example? You plan out into the future in terms of where your revenue is going to come, where shared savings is going to be found, and performance incentives that are built in. So that's one of the key points about when you're in a services business, for example, adjustments to how you're going to generate revenues from your service. And then levelizing or the playing field from changes to how capital expenditures are made versus operating expenditures. An example of that from a solar industry perspective, often we talk to people about how they can fund a solar investment in terms of if they don't have the capital budget, possibly using a lease mechanisms, for example, to avoid capital expenditure and paying for those lease payments out of your operating budget, i.e. what you were going to pay anyways for that electricity. And when you look at the numbers, it works out where you're taking costs from operating monies to pay for an asset without having to allocate capital to that. That's important. And then the retirement of uneconomical performing assets, i.e. that coal plant that I mentioned. And then reimagining the utility business in terms of where is revenue going to come and what type of new value-added services you're going to make. And the point I was making before about electric vehicles, that's an opportunity for utilities to sell more of their products and services. And in the case of electric vehicles, that may ultimately sell back power at night to the grid. That's a value-add service that's an option for a utility to provide a service and derive revenue not only for themselves but also for customers. Other options get into how you tweak your cost models and in turn retiring those assets, but retaining really and working towards balancing your business in terms of reimagining what the future is going to look like. And what impacts these reforms are going to be items associated with policy, both at the state and federal level, legislation, enabling legislation that may lead to a policy that stimulates the market to grow and place incentives in place to retire underperforming or uneconomical assets. It's really key to these reform options being successful and what the future is going to behold. So in terms of that initiation, that can occur certainly at the regulatory level with the public service commissions and the legislature, which may enact a law or enabling legislation, which we'll talk about recently with grid modernization here in Missouri. And then utility proposals. So these initiations that come together can come from different sources or stakeholders that are involved with respect to getting something done to enable a utility to move forward with initiatives that help their business and help the communities that they serve. So in terms of when you look at the process of reform, it's clear to state what the goals are going to be and issue guidance on how those goals, on the process and the goals, and the structure that's going to be followed at the regulatory level. Because keep in mind, again, utilities are monopolies and they are regulated businesses, and they need permission to enact these changes to the business. You know, case in point, every time a new rate is desired, they have to file for rates with Public Service Commission. It takes time and money to get those rates approved, but it's important to understand that that is part of the process and moving forward. There are methods and incentives to deploy new regulatory mechanisms and implement those reforms. And then you have to evaluate whether they're successful or not and refine as needed. But what we're showing here is really a process for continuous improvement as you implement a new program. So the results, when you look at the results and what the measurements are going to be, is how did I improve the business in terms of reducing my cost, for example, passing those cost savings on. In the case of, and we'll talk more about with grid modernization in Missouri, what's involved there. But not only reducing my cost, but the overall profitability that I'm going to be able to deliver to my shareholders. So that's what we're looking for with respect to the reform of the business model, with respect to utilities and changes as the grid modernization occurs, for example, and we transition from where we're at today to what the future beholds. So, and some specifics on Missouri. In Missouri, we had this past legislative session, we saw grid modernization legislation in the form of Senate Bill 564 was passed, which reduced electric rates and put a freezes in place for the next 5 years. And a grid modernization plan, which is a five-year plan to update the grid, again, dealing with issues associated with resiliency, cybersecurity, for example, and being able to recover in the event of a natural disaster, adding new smart technologies, and, of course, creating jobs and allocating over $1 billion towards grid modernization is one of the objectives of the bills. And it also enabled solar rebates to be paid again here in not only Kansas City area, but St. Louis and Jeff City by the three investor-owned utilities. Currently, there's a 50 cents a watt incentives available for solar customers. That'll ratchet down to 25 cents after the first of the year. June 30th, with respect to the current rebate program. And we can talk more of that offline. And then, of course, economic development, again, creating jobs. Because if you think about, again, policy at the state level, legislation policy enables the utilities to actually implement programs, that does create jobs. So in turn, on the Kansas side, Kansas reform, it's kind of a question mark right now. We all know that KCPL and Westar is merging to create Evergy. There are regulatory issues that need to be addressed at the KCC level. There was a recent change in rate structures for existing solar customers of Westar that was implemented in terms of the tariff, which is not favorable for solar customers in Kansas. Again, that was done. There was, of course, public hearings and everything, but it was a foregone conclusion. And what this change in rate structure did, where you have in the past net metering, when you net meter, you produce more than you use, put it on the grid, you get full retail credit. And in turn, when you use those credits to buy power from the utility, it just comes out as a wash in your bill. In turn, this change in tariffs for solar customers introduced a demand charge and reduced the energy rate or the kilowatt hour rate for customers with solar. And what that causes a customer who had an expectation for a return on investment and payback for a system, that throws that all out of kilter in terms of that return on investment and payback analysis. So that is an issue, and there were efforts by the Climate and Energy Project has been providing leadership in Kansas on this issue, and not only providing leadership on that issue, but as well as energy efficiency and this, promoting the solar industry. Here recently, the solar industry in Kansas joined a subgroup of the Climate and Energy Project called the Clean Energy Business Network, and that's a group that can take the message forward in terms of where the industry stands or and what type of policies we would collectively like to see in place in Kansas. In Missouri, it was successful because it was there was collaboration between the Solar Energy Industry Association, MOSIA, the utilities, as well as Renew Missouri and other advocacy groups. That's what got Senate Bill 564 passed, was collaboration. Unfortunately, that model has not taken hold in Kansas, but with the change in leadership at the state level now, we can hope that there will be changes in the future that will favor modernization in these areas and favor renewables. On a nationwide basis, there's a movement to push the policy changes quite hard, climate change policy very, very hard. Are any of you familiar or heard about the Sunrise Movement? Any nods there? How about the Green New Deal? We got to get a few nods here. Well, with the recent elections, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is who's not been sworn in yet, but it's quite cool what she's doing. She's leading the movement to establish a select committee in the House to create the Green New Deal and transition really our economy from a carbon economy to be carbon neutral and draw down and capture greenhouse gases, promote economic development, and really also promote economic and environmental justice and equity. There's some interesting information on this link to her website, but the point being on this, we're all frustrated with our elected officials. Because they'll study something and not do anything. But what this is all about is an effort to put together a plan, get it passed and executed and funded. This committee that she's advocating for, it's intended to actually have authority to move legislation through. So we hope that she's successful in her endeavors with this. And it's exciting from the standpoint of moving forward. I want to just wrap up in that being in the solar industry all these years, as Craig said, we started in 03. There's a term that we use, the solar coaster, and it's like a roller coaster, and that's what we've been on. When I started in the industry, there was just another company, Cromwell Solar, Aaron Cromwell, over in Lawrence, and I believe there was a guy down in Joplin as well, and that was it. There were just three or four companies in the area, in the state, actually. Ultimately, with the establishment of renewable energy standards or renewable portfolio standards, that drove the local industry where we had rebates and a lot more people have gotten into the business. Companies have come and gone with rebates, with the drastic drop in cost of equipment and the efficiencies related to installation of systems. It's all gone down. Missouri employment directly with solar installers is about 3,000 people. Kansas, there's really no hard numbers, but I think the number is around 300, 350. Cromwell over in Lawrence and Good Energy are two of the larger companies in Kansas. There's a large company down in Wichita, and large by definition is probably 25 to 50 people at the most. Policy, both at the local and the national level, has driven our industry. Tariffs were a speed bump in the industry with solar module pricing earlier this year, that's gone away due to worldwide supply. There's a glut of modules on the market, so the tariffs have not been impacted. But on a local level, we've been fortunate that KCPL has been supportive of solar. They have an operating company on their non-regulated side called KCPL Solar, which is focused on working with nonprofits to implement solar. And so there's a good working relationship overall with utilities, the investor-owned utilities. And in the beginning, that was not the case when we started out in the industry and this Missouri passed its renewable energy standard. But there's a lot of collaboration going on for the good. And when you think about how utilities are changing, their business models are changing with the electric grid and transition, the solar industry has impacted how they're doing business. And I foresee quite a bit of collaboration going forward because we're all in this together. So with that, we'll open ourselves up for questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob.
Yes, Craig.
Yeah, hi, Bob. Since many of us are most interested in reducing carbon, I'll put that as the kind of the baseline for the question, what is the most effective thing that can happen in this transition to the grid? Is it decoupling? Or what is the thing that will, what is the change in the industry that will result the most effectively in reducing carbon? And how do we as consumers have an impact on that type of transition that reduces carbon with utilities? What should we be doing?
Well, the key, I think the key to all of the, what you're talking about, it really involves policies that are put in place that really promote distributed energy generation, meaning you produce it and use it at the place where you're generating it. In turn, the excess is then put on the grid. And in the case of a utility is providing a valuable service to move that energy to someone that could use that and in turn compensate the generator for that. It, in my opinion, is going to be a major step forward because that addresses the carbon question, but also addresses the resiliency and the security aspects. A case in point, the California fires are demonstrating the need for more deployment of, for example, microgrids. And microgrids, a general term, bringing a bunch of generation assets together, managing them effectively. But that's distributed energy generation and involves solar battery storage, utility, and other generation sources. So I see those things coming together. But The other point is vehicle, electrical vehicles, the adoption of more EVs. And, of course, we're seeing more products coming on the market, which are really important things. Because stop and think. It's one thing about electrical generation and their contribution to the issues related to climate change. But think about vehicles. And if you have a cleaner grid that powers vehicles, that's a big plus. So we're tackling two of the major problems contributing to really excess carbon being generated. Hope that gives you an idea. That's my personal opinion on things. Yes.
Hello. I'm Jim Turner of Missouri Sierra Club. We know that grid scale battery storage is now being used in California and out on the East Coast. And recently at a informational meeting in Independence, Missouri, I heard discussion about whether they should buy a share, make a big investment in a share of a gas-powered production plant, or whether, as an alternative, they should plan on waiting 2 years or so for the cost of battery storage to come down enough so that that would be a good alternative for them to provide the capacity they need in their system. So that sounds exciting, that battery storage on a grid scale is within a couple of years, they think, could become low enough to be realistic to put into a system.
That's correct. Here on, well, I would, not knowing the financials specific to that project, but I would put a couple of points out there. The technology is here today, the large-scale battery storage. The business case today that's in place involves typically how can we reduce our demand charges, for example. In the event of a power outage, how long could the batteries sustain us, for example, without having to shut down a facility? Those are important points. Here on a local basis, there is a company here in Lee Summit called Exergonics. It's in the business of manufacturing these large-scale battery solutions. And they have deployed, they currently have one deployed with KCPL over on Troost. In that case, that dealt with a power quality problem. But there are factors that impact the financial decision to make that investment, and you touched upon a few of those. You look at natural gas generation option or batteries. And the core technology today for batteries is lithium technology in batteries. And there's quite a bit of movement in the industry nowadays with new products. GE is manufacturing a solution they call Reservoir, which is really an interesting piece of technology in the industry today to address these types of projects. So the future for storage is further going to be enhanced by the extension of the investment tax credit to allow battery storage projects to be done without solar. There's an effort to get legislation passed in the lame duck Congress that's coming up to make that happen. Currently, if you're going to use the ITC, the investment tax credit of 30%, there has to be a solar component to it, and there's some specific criteria that have to be addressed. So go ahead.
Every so often you hear about a massive blackout relating to transmission line failure. And I wondered if you could discuss the continuing need as time goes by for investment in more modern and more efficient and safer transmission line facilities nationwide. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I'm not really qualified to talk about transmission lines because that's my area of expertise. But again, how I would best answer that If you're investing in distributed generation, energy resources for distributed generation at the local level, you're taking the stress off those transmission assets. So, and that gets into, often, those of us in the solar industry have always talked about the value of solar and what is the value of solar. And if you can reduce this stress on assets, generation, transmission, and distribution assets, there's quite a bit of value there. And again, that's one of the trends that we're seeing enacted with various investments being made and so forth. So that's about the best way that I can answer that. I know there's new technologies in transmission lines with the Greenbelt efforts in Missouri to more effectively and efficiently move power from one part of the country to the other. So that's one of the variables that affects this. So go ahead.
First of all, I'll let you know, I have a 4-kilowatt solar system on my roof.
Oh, good for you.
And we're in our third year now of it. And I was just wondering, what I'm reading is that Missouri's been fairly, or at least the Kansas City area, has been fairly receptive to solar through KCP&L, whereas Kansas seems to be active to try to keep it from coming in. And do you think the change in administration in Kansas may have an effect on that?
The short answer to your question is yes. As one of the companies that's a member of the Clean Energy Business Network, prior to the election, we did meet with Laura Kelly. She was made time for us, spent a whole hour, and we educated her on the issues affecting the industry in Kansas, and not only the issues, but what are the potential benefits allowing the industry to grow. And in the case of solar and storage, just like we talked about utilities, these are business decisions. Folks make decisions to invest on solar purely on economics as their first criteria. How much is it going to save me? What's my payback? And then, again, what's the return on investment? That's how folks think and make their decisions. So when you look at how the solar industry has grown nationwide, there's more than 250,000 people employed in the industry installing solar and storage in this country. And that doesn't take into account the folks that are manufacturing or distributing equipment, et cetera. So it's from the economic perspective, it's good business. It's for the state of Kansas. So I'm optimistic we'll see some changes. They're not going to happen overnight. But some of those changes have to occur with the KCC. And from my understanding, there's another group or an board that was funded. It deals with consumers. But that organization has never been funded to review these rate cases and provide the consumer point of view in Kansas. So that's been a problem. And staffing the energy office, the state energy office, that office has contracted quite a bit over the last handful of years. So, and those things have to change in order for an industry to grow. So, and to make it a levelized playing field, that's what has to happen in Kansas. I hope that answers your question.
My question is directly related to his question. I'm wondering, is there a senator, for example, who has been particularly vocal in Kansas about trying to get legislation similar to what was passed in Missouri? Is there some place that, or some person we can kind of focus on to listen to get a feel about how things are progressing in that respect?
Yes, there is. And really the conduit into all of that is the Climate and Energy Project, Dorothy Barnett's group and her team.
Who is Dorothy Barnett?
She's the executive director.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Of the Climate and Energy Project. And we've had lunch with, and the name escapes me, is a senator from Olathe who headed up the utility committee. He's very, at the time, he was very interested in seeing the energy efficiency in the solar agenda at least begin to move forward in the legislature. So it really starts with folks identifying, to your point, who are the key people to talk to get involved and promote the message to them.
Obviously our own senators, but also somebody like the senator from Olathe?
Yes. Even if you don't live in that area, again, it's getting in contact with them. So I would recommend contacting Dorothy's group and finding out, or getting involved as, you know, whatever level you're comfortable with, and finding out who to talk to and provide that input. Because, again, I think the what we're seeing in the country overall and at the local level, the more active folks are, that'll begin to get legislators' attention, get them to change their perspective on things, bring the message to them, and put pressure on them. So I hope that answers your question.
Yes. I understand that Tesla is coming up with a battery for residential that goes into a wall that's available over in Australia. And my question has to do you think, like, two of those batteries would probably be enough, but they're about over five grand a piece. Do you think a system like that would be preferable over net metering if a person is looking to invest? And, like, two of those batteries would probably cover all the needs of a household.
Yeah, what you're referring to is the Tesla Powerwall, which is available in select U.S. markets. You order it through the Tesla stores. To your point, it's my opinion that it's a better return on if you put solar in, you store it and use it yourself as opposed to net metering. I think in the long run there's a better return on investment there for you. So, and in terms of, there are products not only like the Tesla Powerwall, LG or LG Chem, they make a similar product that has similar performance characteristics to the Powerwall. There's a company called SolarEdge, which makes an inverter and storage products, which they have the technology that deals with what's referred to as self-consumption from battery storage. And that's the direction you want to go. And that does make big differences to folks as opposed to net metering, in my opinion. So,
thanks a lot, Bob. Yeah. I have here your official mug,
thank you.
U.S. and Union made. And next week, we're going to have advocating for a food and farm bill, emphasis on food instead of farm or big ag, really. Be Paul Johnson. He was going to be last week, but because of the snow, had to be canceled. So he's going to be next Sunday instead, so be sure and catch that. Thanks for coming to the forum.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Our Electrical Grid in Transition with Bob Solger. This program was recorded on Sunday, December 2nd at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.